that should be playing. Oh, hang on. One just moment. Hang on 1 second. Let me start over again.
All right.
Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web, while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in a series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. You know, thus is the place where the past meets the future. If you have done your genealogy and found that you have roots in the Irish or Scottish clans, then don't you think it would be a great idea to have a replica of your family crest? You can get a coat of arms, a ring, or even a family tartan that may help you or your grandchildren remember your ancestors. This is the time when the hearts of the children are turned to the hearts of the fathers. We only carry the best. So if you're ready to experience the glory of your past, you're ready to visit Scottish Heirlooms at X Squared Radio. Welcome to X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew, your host, where the past meets the future. The solar wind tonight is a mild 355.5 kilometers per second.
Sunspot 898 is huge, but poses little threat to Earth at this time. It is beautifully organized, and recent photos of it show great details of the magnetic fields, the sinuous filaments of the sunspot's outer penumbra. After years of study, these filaments are still not fully understood. Do they hold the sunspot together, or are they conduits for solar plasma? It's a beautiful mystery. Scientists are only beginning to unravel it. We want to encourage you to write us with the call letters of your local AM radio station. We will write them and try to get X Squared Radio on their program schedule for live broadcast. We want you to know that we are coming to you live through the BBS radio network and through the satellite feed via the Global Star Radio Network. The launch of the Space Shuttle Discovery has been postponed for an additional 48 hours due to inclement weather at Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Our next attempt will take place on Tuesday, July 4th, with liftoff scheduled to occur at 2:38 p.m. That's well before the fireworks displays. But those of you that live in the southeastern U.S., you should keep an eye peeled that afternoon. Look for a light moving at about Mach 20 toward the heavens. It should be visible with the naked eye. Next week on X Squared Radio, we will have Lloyd Pye on the program. Are you aware that the preserved remains of an alien have been found on Earth? That's right. The DNA study of the remains of what has been called the Star Child are being examined by the world's best authorities in human genome research, and the results are in. The Star Child is not from around here. You will also learn about the most compelling intervention theory. Don't miss next week's program. Remember, we are at a new time beginning at 6 p.m. Eastern instead of 5 p.m. If you want to stay current on our programs, guests, books, CDs, DVDs, and other outstanding stuff for your space, you can make X Squared Radio your favorite place on the web by going to x2-radio.com. We want to welcome our AM affiliates and your many requests that this program be placed onto XM and Sirius. I believe everything we do will eventually affect the universe, and your efforts are having their effect, and I appreciate it. We are so glad you are with us live tonight. Many of our radio affiliates are carrying the program for less than the full 3 hours. If that is the case where you live, please write them and ask that they broadcast the entire program. Tonight, we have a special guest, Michael Tellinger, graduated from Wits University in 1983 with a Bachelor of Pharmacy degree. In 2000, he was given his own weekly radio show on Cape Talk Radio that dealt with South African innovation, technology, and success stories. He has written more than a dozen screenplays, but Slave Species of God is his first published book as a result of a 25-year obsession with science and the cosmos. That I understand. The human genome research that has been done proves that our roots are more interesting than we once were taught. He has dispelled archaic myths that belong in the Dark Ages and provides clear-thinking individuals with the information to reach new conclusions. He wants to share with every reader the same incredible sense of discovery that he personally experienced as he unraveled the utter rubbish which he was conditioned to believe through his formative years, as terrible as this new truth may sound. How about that? Please welcome with me Michael Tellinger. Is it Tellinger or Tellinger?
Hi, Brooks. Thank you very much. It's Tellinger. But Tellinger will do for now, anyway.
Well, very good. I have been just fascinated by the results of human genome research that has been done in the last 10 years. We are, in my opinion, so close to many, discovering cures to diseases, discovering how to help so many people. I can't help but think, you know, where we're going to be in 20 years or perhaps 200 years. But when I get that far in my imagination, I find that the things we can imagine suddenly become reality. And if they are real to us, then maybe they are real to other races in the universe. And then I discovered your awesome work called Slave Species of God. I just had to have you on the program. I guess my first question is, you have had such a variety of great experiences in your life and achieved so many awesome things. How did you become fascinated with this subject?
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Brooks. I really appreciate being on your show, and I feel humble talking to a man of your kind of caliber and stature. I suppose my first interest was really stirred when, I think, my first year at university, somebody dropped Eric von Däniken's Chariots of the Gods in my lap and said, you should read this, it's quite interesting. And that really changed my life, you know, and from then I started really questioning and exploring and trying to see if there's something hidden behind the facade of what we've been taught by our schooling system and universities. And the more you scratch, as you all know, the more you discover that what we are often taught is not necessarily so, or not necessarily the absolute truth, and there are other ways of seeing things. And that has been my driving force in exploring this the subject of the origins of humankind.
Well, I know when your life of entertainment and life of writing screenplays, when it slows down and it's nothing but Michael in the room, and you're imagining about all of this information that, you know, it's exciting you and it's interesting you, and you find yourself at least scientifically lacking maybe the credentials to go after these advanced research projects. I'm interested, what books did you read? Did you go on the internet? Did you look up abstracts? Did you read other people's works? I mean, it from what you have produced, it appears you have done a tremendous amount of research. I just would like to know, you know, how you went after it.
You know, I tried to list as many of the sources that I used for my research in the end of my book, at the end of the book, but I found that it sort of almost defeated the object, because there were so many sources and that I used over the years that often I couldn't even remember where I had found something. I had to go in search of it and find a derivative of it somewhere else. But it's been books, many, many, many books, hundreds, if not thousands of books that I had to go through. And then the internet, and thank God for technology, because it really makes it much easier to do research on the internet, and it allows you information at your fingertips, especially if you quickly want to scan and just you know, make sure that you double check something, like, you know, what are the seven wonders of the world again, and what are the modern seven wonders and the ancient seven wonders, just in case you might have gotten it wrong. Instead of having to shoot off to the library, you can quickly check it up. And so the sources were, yeah, as you say, lots of books, many, many books, and a lot of surfing and searching for interesting articles on the internet. And sometimes, you know, I found that I would find the most obscure website and the most obscure person who had something really interesting to contribute and never been heard of before, you know.
You know, I've been long making the case that organized academia is losing its monopoly on this knowledge. One of the things that really excites me is we no longer have to say, well, you know, I want to be interested in archaeological digs. It's just really interesting to me. I think I'll go up to the university and enroll and take a class. Those days are over. Those days are over. We can now go take a class and we can pour ourselves into it and literally in 30 days absorb as much as we could in an entire semester, because just like you mentioned, you've got this fire inside of you that's just driving you to get this knowledge, because you have a question that you need an answer for. Now, once you get the answer, though, did it drive you to write this book?
Oh, very much so. You know, I'm sure you know the feeling, and many listeners who are writers themselves will certainly sympathize with this. Once you start and you actually get that bug, it is like it's like an infection. You know, it consumes you.
Yeah, when you catch it, you're cured.
Yeah, you got to just. I mean, I just started writing, and I would start at 5 a.m. and suddenly look up, and it was 4 p.m, and I hadn't moved an inch from my, you know, from my desk, and all I've been doing is doing research, you know, cataloging all my information and so forth, and suddenly say, well, maybe I should go and have some lunch, you know, and this lasted
exactly
for months,
right.
You know, and you've got to force yourself to take a break, otherwise you'll actually won't get any water in, you won't get any food in. But it you know it reminds me what you just said now is when I was in standard 7, which would be grade 9 in American terms. I remember asking in biology class one day, the teacher drew the human cell or the animal cell on the board and explained how the cell works and so forth and said, well, you know, that's how it all functions. And I said, put my hand up and I said, okay, well, if this is how the cell functions, and it's a perfectly perfectly contained little unit that regenerates itself every so many hours or so many days, why is it that we die? And there just wasn't an answer forthcoming. And I must admit that that was in the early 70s, and, you know, the teachers in those days probably didn't know much about genetics. And so she didn't really have an answer. I said, well, that's just the way it is. And that was that answer has forever been imprinted in my mind. And now as I look into what's happening in the Human Genome Project and how we're unraveling the DNA of other species, suddenly you start saying, but that's not necessarily the way it has to be forever, because we are coming ever so close to understanding the DNA and our human genome and the DNA of other species. And very soon we're going to come to terms with immortality. And that's going to be a very interesting time in our species' existence.
Yeah, it does seem that we have been at least socially programmed that all things die. You know, all men die. It's one of the sure things that we can look forward to on the earth. But maybe it wasn't always so. Maybe death didn't come to us in 70 years, 70 annual trips around the sun. And I would guess, even with this research and this great book, that you're not done with the subject, are you?
No, I'm not. You know, I was just sitting here working alongside my girlfriend tonight. She's doing some late night work, as you know. It's midnight here in Johannesburg, so we've had a long day already. But we've just been talking about it now, and I said, you know, I wish I could actually just stop doing what I'm doing and carry on writing another book, because I'm suddenly so inspired, and I feel that I have so much more to take it to another level. And there's so many different levels that you can take it to. You know, I mean, for your listeners that don't know what Slave Species of God deals with, maybe I should just quickly outline the fact that it deals with an alternative theory of the origins of humankind and where we come from and how we ended up here as a species and suddenly appearing on Earth some thousands of years ago and have no real clue as to how we ended up here as a human race. And what's interesting, just to come back a little bit, is what seems to be becoming more and more clear to me is that as we evolve, not necessarily physically, but most certainly emotionally, and as we evolve, our intelligence evolves. We are starting to understand and coming to terms more with our spirituality, as we ask larger questions about what is going on in the universe and outside of planet Earth. And I've had a lot of emails from readers around the world that ask me questions about what is your view on God with a big G and the creator of the universe and all things in it and spirituality. And it's an interesting crossing point, an interesting place where the lines cross, and that would make a fascinating book to follow up Slave Species of God.
Well, that brings us right into the opening of your book. You know, you one of the things that you latch on to right at the beginning of your book, and it's basically true about our civilization. Since the dawn of recorded time, and I want to put in parenthetically that this is kind of the middle of the story because, modern science would have us believe that we all began as some group of amino acids and then through some probabilities became a one-celled animal and through some other probabilities we became a more organized creature and we crawled forth out of the primordial ooze and before you know it, here we are playing Xbox. But,
nah.
You know, when I talk about the dawn of recorded time, I mean that man arrived on the planet as a finished product. And one of the things that shows up from day one, from the first stylus to clay, there is a mention of two obsessions. The first is slavery and the almost genetically insane quest for gold of some kind. Why do you think this is?
Well, that's it. You ripped out the guts out of my book. That's it, because it really deals with slavery and gold. Those are, according to my research, the only two common denominators that one can trace back to the earliest times of human existence. And it's absolutely fascinating why man, primitive man, 200,000 years ago or 100,000 years ago or even much more recently, was so obsessed with gold. I mean, if you look at the book of Genesis in Bible, in Genesis 2, God already says to the Israelites, he says, you're my chosen people. I'm going to take you to the land of milk and honey. But first we're going to destroy the Canaanites and the Amorites and the Zebulites and everything that ends with ites. And I'm going to take you to the land of milk and honey because that's where I want you to stay. There's good water and there's also good gold. The gold of the land is good. Now, you know, you've got to ask yourself, why would God, the creator of the universe and all things, be so obsessed with gold? And why would man have this need for gold? I mean, it's a absolutely fascinating subject. And, you know, the average historian or person of that caliber will tell you, well, because gold is very appealing in its allure and it has value and all these kind of things, but you know, that's utter rubbish because humans were digging for gold and refining gold thousands of years ago, long before they were even working with any other metals, and there were many more easily obtainable metals and objects on Earth that were shinier, that were glittered more, that they could have had, obtained with greater ease. Why this obsession with gold?
And it really...
Another beautiful example, sorry to interrupt you there, Brooks, is God's instructions to Moses in the Sinai Desert. Here these poor people are in the middle of the desert. They got no food, no water. And he gives them these very clear instructions as to how to build the ark out of pure gold. So now they first got to go and find gold somewhere. What the hell is all this about, you know? Who is this God that's telling them to do all these weird things? And the very specific detail that goes into the construction of the ark out of pure gold, which ends with, put the mercy seat on top of the ark between the wings of the cherubim and meet me there, I will meet you there when I will give you instructions as to what to tell your people. And you start questioning this and saying, okay, what is going on here? What is this ark all about?
Yeah, why don't we learn how to make rows in the dirt, plant seeds, pour water on them, and we can have something to eat instead of something to look at.
Yeah.
And even before the ark, somehow when Moses led the Jews out of Egypt, I mean, if I'm going to take a trek out into the desert, I'm going to take the bare essentials. But no, these people brought their gold with them.
Yeah.
And when they got out there, as soon as Moses left them alone, they melted the gold down and made a golden calf. At
yeah.
least if Cecil B. DeMille's depiction of the event is accurate.
Not only that, but God also instructs them to actually pillage their neighbor's belongings and take the gold with them.
Yeah, take their gold.
Yeah,
and it's really not all
well.
That rare of an element unless, you know, I mean, it's been mined off this planet for dozens and dozens of centuries, and I don't know nobody that doesn't possess some gold.
Yeah.
Every single person on the planet has a gold ring or a gold pendant or a gold earring or something. Gold is not very rare at all, and it's, you know, not really a very strong metal. Certainly it doesn't tarnish, but there are other metals that don't tarnish. It's just interesting, and it's kind of what caught me about your book. And, you know, I recently learned that the science of archaeology was only established in the mid-1800s. I thought that was just fascinating. I guess the rich and the eccentric had been looting and hoarding, you know, ancient knowledge for centuries. But
and that's exactly what it is. You know, archaeologists, or what we often refer to as archaeologists, were nothing but souvenir hunters.
They were grave robbers.
It was like the Wild West. Yeah, exactly. Go find what you can. Find some ancient archaeological site. Loot it. Take the contents to your place and sell it to the man with the deepest pockets. Yeah.
Right. But recently, knowledge of what's been found, even by some of these eccentric travelers, has come out. You know, there have been plates and scrolls and tablets and all kinds of things that filled up museums and sat on mantelpieces of aristocrats, but now it's being interpreted. And what I'd like to know is what you have found that this tells us about the oldest known civilizations on Earth.
Well, you know, this is where it becomes really interesting. Because, I mean, I'm not the first person to talk about this. There have been many authors before me and scholars of great stature that have written about this. I mean, obviously, your listeners will know people like Zachariah Sitchin, which probably is the most prominent translator and writer about the Sumerian tablets, which is, as far as we know today, are still the oldest written record of human history. And we are translating more and more of these Sumerian tablets, and it's not just one person doing it. There's many, many people around the world, and growing by the day and by the week. You know, many of the top universities in America and the UK, including Oxford University, now have dedicated departments that actually specifically focus on the translation of Sumerian tablets.
But the one thing that I really don't hear coming out of institutions, but I do hear coming out of people like Zachariah Sitchin and yourself and others, is that there were ancient powers on Earth that ruled mankind with an iron fist. And I'd like to know what you think, how they got here. How did those rulers get here?
You know, we've got to look at the very dark and strange days of the early years of human civilizations. First of all, you know, when did civilization really begin? And as far as domestication of animals, of agriculture, living in communities, towns or villages, that kind of thing, and providing for each other, only really started after the flood of some 13,000 years ago, or 11,000 BC, or around that time. And you know, for some listeners, it might come as a shock, but there actually was such an event as the flood during that period, which is the end of the last ice age. And the way we're messing up the world at the moment, it looks like we're approaching a new ice age quite quickly. But if you look at the oldest writings and the translations that have started emerging from these Sumerian tablets, they are quite staggering. And it's not just one man that's translating it, Zachariah Sitchin. There's many others. The Schoen collection in Oslo has got over 5,000 clay tablets that are sitting there that have been translated. And if you read what they say, it actually concurs with everything people like Sitchin have been saying. And every now and then, if you log onto the websites that deal with the translations of the Sumerian tablets, they all say pretty much the same thing. They talk about a time before time that they received their knowledge and their information from. And they refer to the gods of ancient times that came to earth and set up the cities and set up the laws and set up the entire infrastructure and taught man everything he knew from planting crops and surviving on this planet. And it also talks about the fact that these gods, that came, the point in time came that these gods that came to earth decided to create a slave species or a lesser intelligent species to help them with their quest for gold. And then suddenly it comes out that this is the reason why we have this obsession with gold, is because there were these advanced beings that came to this planet, travelers from wherever they came from, that came here looking for one specific reason, and that they came here looking for gold. And then suddenly, as you look at it, as you step away, you go, and you know, at first it sounds a little far-fetched, but the more you dig and the more you scratch, this obsession with gold permeates every aspect of our humanity for as long as we can trace it back. And it suddenly starts to make a lot more sense why this obsession with gold has enslaved humanity until today.
And, well, that brings up some questions for me. Which came first then, mankind or the ancient rulers, the works of stone all over the earth seem to honor? Mankind was here first, and then the off-worlders came here?
Not according to my research and what I've uncovered.
So when the off-worlders came here, there was nothing here but plants and animals.
There were animals, there were plants, there was evolution taking place on Earth.
Okay.
Like there is most likely happening on many countless other planets and around the universe. And that, you know, that science is very clearly supported by the concept of panspermia, which you're obviously familiar with, which is the concept that seeds of life, you know, are travel through space and are present in space and in all of the universe. And these seeds of life are picked up by comets and meteors and asteroids as they travel through space and time. And eventually when they crash into a planet, as we recently witnessed with Shoemaker-Levy that crashed into Jupiter,
mm-hmm.
when these comets do crash into planets and they deposit these seeds of life and start a whole chain reaction of evolutionary processes. And
I don't have a problem with a frozen ball of ice containing tadpoles in it, and it crashes into our ocean, and those tadpoles become reanimated and they thrive in our environment and a new ecology is born. I don't have a problem with that, but it's a big jump from a tadpole to a human.
Yeah, it certainly is.
And the records that we have, at least in the Christian world, are that, you know, mankind was delivered here. He was made out of the elements that are on the earth, which may also be elements that are present everywhere in the universe.
Yep.
But he's a built being, engineered by God or by a creator or creators. And it actually uses the word plurally over 30 times in Genesis 1. So
we created man.
Yeah, in our image.
Only in Genesis books, the Quran continues that. And the Quran also talks about, you know, how we created man from clots of blood, and do they not know that we created Adam, and often refers to God in the plural, which substantiates and corroborates much of what is written in the ancient Sumerian tablets.
Sure.
About the gods that arrived on earth in search of gold, and that at some point decided that they were going to create a primitive worker to help them get this gold out of the ground.
I understand that too. I guess at some point we have to ask ourselves, okay, did Adam and Eve have belly buttons or did they not? And I think, you know, if we know animal physiology the way we know it now, yes, it is possible to create a higher being, but it's almost impossible, at least to our science or to our extended science, to grow that being in a test tube. We can create a single cell or a zygote, but then it has to be implanted in a womb, and it has to come to term and be delivered. But when it is delivered, it's a baby. And, of course, a baby can't be put in the Garden of Eden. It has to be raised up, and the human brain doesn't, achieve its full size and become really self-aware until the age of about 12. Some people much older than that. But in any case, a self-sustaining being that can actually do work and take care of itself. So Adam and Eve, or at least Adam, is delivered to the Garden of Eden, and then much later Eve, who's genetically engineered out of his rib, at least that we have clearly in Genesis.
Yep.
But I guess my question is, when the off-worlders got here, there was nothing here but this beautiful blue marble in space, and somehow in the vast emptiness, without any radio waves, without any emanations or radiations, they found this little planet, and this little solar system was only 9 planets in it, and they found gold on it, and they decided to mine it, but being small in number, they decided to breed or design for themselves this slave species. So,
yeah,
that's certainly
what it seems like, and that's certainly what comes off the pages of and out of the translations of the Sumerian tablets. Not only did they decide to do that, but they also they deliberated about it. They weren't quite sure that it was the right thing to do. From some of the translations, they actually do refer in some of the tablets to the creator of all, which is an interesting concept for people who believe in a God and a creator of the universe and all things in it, because these so-called creators of mankind who arrived on this planet had a moral dilemma about this thing, whether they should create another species on this new planet that they arrived on. And, we shouldn't find it so difficult. I mean, you mentioned it yourself. You know, we can clone species. We clone pets. America is full of pet cloning companies already. We don't have them in South Africa yet, but I bet you within the next year or two, they're probably going to open their doors here as well.
In the press, we have been at least publicly putting on the show that we're arguing about or at least discussing about, is it moral or not to use fetuses to use stem cells?
Because yeah.
Stem cells are actually the basic evolutionary cell in humans. I know you've heard it a lot in the press, but it's basically a cell that can become anything. It can become a tooth, or it can become a bone, or eye tissue, or the inner layer of your mouth or fingernails. It can become anything we direct it to be. And what we're, I guess, playing with by experimentation, because we don't really have theories to do this, is we're trying to see which button to push to make the cell do what we want it to do.
Yep.
And although great and noble our cause seems to be, yes, we want to put spinal cords back together. Yes, we want to cure diabetes or restore a limb to the body. The funding dollars that are really driving this research are not interested in that at all, are they?
It certainly seems like they've got some real problems with that. You know, I'm a scientist at heart, and I believe that you can't hold back progress. And if you do try and hold it back, it will surface at some stage or on some forbidden island somewhere, and then come back and bite you in the bum. But what's interesting, you brought up the idea of stem cells now, because while we are now grappling with stem cells, and suddenly stem cells have become a very heated subject, and people are debating it all over the world, embryonic stem cells or adult stem cells from bone marrow, obviously embryonic stem cells are the preferred ones because they're much easier to guide in a specific direction and grow into different organs. So now suddenly people are imagining sort of organ farms all over the place where people grow organs of all kinds for, from kidneys and hearts to, whatever. But at the same time, all these defects that we're trying to cure or replace, the organs that we're trying to replace by growing them out of stem cells, can actually be cured and fixed with genetic manipulation and genetic engineering. So it brings us all the way back to what we spoke about a few minutes ago, is the DNA and genetic manipulation and how far we've come in that area of science.
Right.
The
and fact that, yeah, we're just scratching the surface with that.
Absolutely. You know, and just the fact that I'll come back to that a little later about the very strange things that the Human Genome Project is uncovering. But we are so close to understanding what actually causes, which parts of our DNA cause death, cell death, and immortality, that I reckon in the next 100 years or so we are going to face a real dilemma about immortality. Now, do we fight that as progress in science, or do we allow that to grow and that knowledge and information to permeate the scientific world? I think it's important and for that reason, I think it's very important to start to grasp and understand the origins of humankind, who we are as a species, why we're here, and how the hell did we get here on this planet? Because what we've been told and what we've been taught by historians and especially by our religious leaders seems to be a big fat lie. And it does not tie up if you start exploring the most recent discoveries about the ancient pre-human history and how this world looked at the earliest of times, during the time of the earliest humans. It doesn't seem to be what we were taught by our historians and religious leaders. The world was a completely different place to what the picture that has been painted in our minds. I had an interesting experience just recently. I was reading a fascinating book on the Knights Templar and you know, with the whole Da Vinci Code and the secret of the Holy Grail and all that. I've read the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail when it first came out many years ago. But then I picked up another book about the Knights Templar and their origins and their rise to fame, fortune, and power. And what became incredibly relevant and staggering as well was the amount of information that can be twisted and turned and kept away from the mainstream of people. And we must remind ourselves at all times that we now live in a global village. For you and I to be able to having this discussion across the Atlantic Ocean, and you broadcasting this from there back to UK via BBC. You know, I mean, this is amazing stuff, and we forget that we have attained a level of technology that sometimes we just take for granted. But if you were to drop a bunch of people on an island and say, well, build me a radio and I want you to broadcast this sound wave from here to the next island, it's not going to happen that easily.
No, it certainly isn't. You know, you were mentioning the fact that we see a big difference in the history that we were fed in school, and maybe even that we can access now just by going down to your local library, and the history that these ancient records and carvings and depictions seem to paint for us. One of the things that sort of rises out of any critical reading of ancient writings, even biblical writings, is the large variety of interactions between God or his assigns in physical form and us.
Yeah.
We don't have that today.
Well, you nailed it on the head. You know, and it seems like that contact between the so-called God and humans sort of came to an abrupt halt when we started exploring mass media and photography and a more reputable way of recording historic events. You know,
well,
suddenly
it seems like the slave species, though, became self-aware and thus uncontrollable, and we decided not to be slaves anymore. Or, in other words, we rebelled. And, you know, even if we were to speak today, if you were to stand up in a public school today and say that there is a visitation like those of old, you would be sued into bankruptcy by the ACLU. You know, why do you think we don't get visited these days?
Well, because, you know, obviously it's pretty clear to us that what was written in the or what is used as a globally used as religious writings of ancient times that billions of people around the world subscribe to and hold up as the holy word of God or their God, you know, one's got to be very careful, because those people that believe verbatim in what is written in the Bible and in the Quran and in the various other religions, you know, they believe that they're dealing with God, the supreme power in the universe that gives them certain power to do certain things. And these are very emotional things that one needs to unravel very gently, and one needs to explain to people, to try and get the religious people to step away from those books and look at them objectively and take the emotion and the religious emotion out of it. And suddenly you start realizing that what has been written in the Bible, and you compare that to what is written in the Sumerian texts and the Sumerian tablets, is one and the same. There are so many ancient situations where men and the humans had interactions with their gods, and not just one god, but many gods. And the oldest religion in the world, the Hindu religion, which stems from the Vedic, the very, very early Vedic scriptures, they are filled with incredible stories of gods coming to earth and interacting with men and smiting men and cloudless skies and meteors falling and thunder and gods flying in cars and chariots, and these are incredible stories.
Why do you think these visitations stopped?
That's a very good question. I mean, I don't personally believe I have the answer for that, or anyone else has an absolute answer for it, and hopefully it will eventually come out. But there are various reasons, I think, or possibilities why they might have stopped. Is that these early settlers, or the gods, our progenitors on Earth, decided to move away from this planet because there was just too much trouble with the human race. That's one possible reason. Another reason is they stopped the contact of visitation, stopped because the humans evolved to a stage, as you mentioned, that they started to actually understand what the hell was going on.
I think humans are questing gold just about as more, you know, more powerfully than they are. And, you know, honestly, it doesn't take 15 minutes of CNN before you become completely familiar with how passionate people hold to their religious beliefs.
Absolutely.
But the other observation that you make, if you're halfway astute, is when you look at these ancient scriptures, let's just take the Bible, it ends. The holy Christian scripture ended centuries ago.
Yeah.
You know, why has there been nothing sent to mankind in the way of holy writings since about 100 AD? Even the ancient writings of civilizations described in the Book of Mormon end in 545 AD. Why nothing now?
Well, you know, many people claim that they have been given the special powers and special scriptures by God. You mentioned the Book of Mormon, one of them, and there have been many others. I can't think of any right now, but if you do some scratching, you'll find plenty of those. People that claim they've been given special, you know, holy scriptures by God himself and so forth. But that is one of the major reasons and questions that I ask in Slave Species of God is to say, why does the Bible end? I mean, surely people need salvation today more than they did 2,000 years ago.
Well, I'll say, certainly.
You know, and if Sodom and Gomorrah were that bad, if the people in those cities were that evil and that vile and were conspiring against God, that he had to wipe out not only those two cities, but several other cities in the valley that they were in. My goodness, where's God today? Because I can tell you right now, in New York City, there are lots more people than there were in Sodom and Gomorrah that are conspiring against God.
Well, we're not trying to, you know, solve religious arguments here, but we are trying to get to the common root that seems to have infused.
Exactly.
It's infused our animal behaviors onto the reverence for rulers not of this earth.
What is fascinating, the other common denominator, one level down after after slavery and gold, is that if you take the origins of all religions on earth, and hereby you have to first come to terms with the fact that all religions on earth are man-made. At some point in time, there was a man, and I can't think of a single religion that was started by a woman at this stage, and certainly not in my research, but all of the religions that I've looked at, and that includes all the major ones and all the offshoots of them, at the point of creation, at the point where the one person decided to start preaching a certain sentiment or certain ideology, there was a high activity and interaction of these ancient gods and these so-called mythological gods who the Sumerian tablets tell us came to earth and created man from the elements of earth. And suddenly you realize that that is another interesting common denominator, because Christians may not be aware of this, but, you know, when Moses was taking the Israelites through the desert, they were still worshipping other gods. They made a statue of gold because they still believed in another god. And suddenly they were punished for that. And even the Muslims also believed in many other gods before Muhammad eventually managed to get them to believe and pray to one god. Prior to that, the Muslim faith believed in several gods. When they first moved into the city of Medina, there were over 300 statues of other gods, or more than that, that they had to break down before they could proclaim Allah as the one and only God. And that goes on, as you know, into Hinduism and into every single religion. At the point of origin of every religion in the world, there is a very active interaction between so-called mythological gods, that today we call mythological, and the people of their day.
Exactly.
Now, this is where you've got to start asking the very, very pertinent question. Where does history end and mythology begin? Or where does mythology end and history begin? And where and how does religion get involved in it? Because at some point in time, we call Roman religion mythology, mythology, mythology. These are Roman gods. And suddenly we get the Roman Catholic Church. And this now becomes an established religion.
Right.
We
go back and we talk about, you know, these gods or these travelers or these creators coming here and genetically engineering mankind. And I guess if we are to take the writings correctly, they were generally created in their image.
Absolutely. That's exactly as it states in the Bible and in the Quran. It repeats it as well. It talks about we have made them in our image. And again, they're using the plural. We have made them and created them in our image. And now suddenly you start understanding this whole DNA, this obsession that I personally have with our DNA and why our DNA is so inferior compared to other species around us. And
we're going to get more into the DNA in the next hour. By the way, I want to remind you, if you're listening via radio broadcast and your local affiliate is not going to carry the next hour, you can go to x2-radio.com or bbsradio.com, and you can pick up the rest of the broadcast, but not before calling that station and asking them to carry our next hour, because we're going to get into this DNA, and it is absolutely fascinating, and you don't have to have a degree in molecular biology to understand it either. We're going to make it very interesting. But my final question for this hour, and this is something that I ran into when reading some of the ancient writings. Once man was made, and, you know, man and woman, and by the way, that might be the problem with all the religions. Maybe we need one founded by a woman. You have now a being that is able to procreate inside its own species. But could the creators breed with female mortals, the way it is said in Genesis, that the sons of God took mortal women and had offspring with them? Did this occur?
Yeah. Well, it certainly seems to be that passage that you quote from Genesis is again a repetition or a diluted version of what is written in some of the Sumerian tablets when they talk about the gods, the sons of the Anunnaki, the sons of Enki and Enlil and the Igigi and so forth. Who were the
now we have hybrids.
Yeah,
we have
descendants of the gods that now started taking this new slave species that was created and having children with them. Now we suddenly have a hybrid species and a very interesting one. And starts to point towards, as you said, what we're going to deal with a bit later about this very interesting DNA problem that we are facing as a species.
And now we have, at least the way you describe it now, we have three different races on the Earth. We have the creators themselves. We
yep.
have their engineered, created being. And
yep.
we have another race, which is a combination of this very advanced, perhaps genetically superior being and the mortal being.
Well, one doesn't even have to say perhaps. I think there's no doubt about it. They were genetically superior. But at the same time, I think we are possibly right now in our state of evolution, maybe not DNA genetic evolution, but mental and spiritual evolution, possibly reaching the same level that these individuals were when they first created Homo sapiens. The other very important thing is that we've got to make it very clear that it seems from the Sumerian tablets as well that, you know, there's no doubt about what color Adam was. Adam was black. And it stipulates it, and it talks about the black-headed ones constantly throughout the ancient scriptures, the black-headed ones and how they were enslaved. And so it's a fascinating story about, you know, the slavery in humanity, how that has perpetuated itself from the earliest of days. We were created as slaves, the human race was created as slaves, and then we started, preying slavery upon our own species. And Africa seems to be the place that slavery has just been exported from since the earliest of days, since the creation of Adam, because this is where Adam was created, the southern tip of Africa. I'm about 20 minutes away from the cradle of man, the cradle of humankind, just north of Johannesburg. And this seems to be the place where the earliest, these new human race species, these clones, were used to mine gold. And guess where most of the gold in the world has been found until relatively recently? Was in southern Africa.
Okay.
Another fascinating thing I'd like to come back a bit later is the whole Zimbabwe ruins precinct, which some of the Americans may not be aware of, or your listeners in that part of the world. And the Great Zimbabwe ruins are a fascinating settlement a ruin here in southern Africa, which I believe plays a crucial role in unraveling the presence of the earliest humans and Adam and his descendants some 250,000 years ago, seemingly, in southern Africa, mining for gold, and how they moved from here into the rest of the world, and the global DNA studies have shown how, you know, the six wives or six sisters of Eve or whatever they call it, how they moved from southern Africa into the rest of the world and populated the rest of the planet. Fascinating stuff.
How about that? Utterly fascinating stuff. Well, my guest tonight is Michael Tellinger. He is the author of Slave Species of God. In our final minute this hour, can you tell our listeners how to get their hands on your book?
Well, you can start by going to the website, which is www.slavespecies.com, and there are various ways that you can get. You can order it on Amazon, or you can order it directly from the distributor in the USA, or just go to your local store, your local bookstore, whether it's Barnes & Noble or whatever, and just ask for it. They should be able to get it for you in a few days.
That is great. Awesome stuff. Well, we will take about 5 minutes of commercial breaks, and we will return. Oh, be very careful. I got to make sure not to jostle my player here too much. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio, and we're coming to you from just west of Charlotte, North Carolina tonight, and we'll be back after these messages. inkjet printer, right? I used to purchase my replacement inkjet cartridges at a national superstore that will remain unnamed. A few months ago, I replaced the color and black cartridges, and the cost was nearly $80. Well, no more. Now, I purchase all my inkjet cartridge and copier supplies from 123 Inkjets. Now, I pay less than $15 per cartridge, and I got free shipping. Plus, every time I buy, I have a chance at winning a brand new printer. How cool is that? All you have to do is click on the 123 Inkjets banner at X Squared Radio, and you get exactly the same savings. Excellent printer supplies at super savings at 123 Inkjets at X Squared Radio. You know we have revealed to you the ancient predictions that natural disasters are going to increase in power and frequency in these times. We might not always have the National Weather Service or the Emergency Broadcasting Service. So you might want to get your hands on some of the best weather reporting instruments around. Visit Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio and pick up something that might be useful. They also have the neatest gift for your favorite people who like things for the outdoors or for their meditation garden. Check out Wind and Weather at X Squared Radio. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today.
It's just music.
The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. This is where the past meets the future. And in here, the results are always positive. My guest this evening is Michael Tellinger. His book is Slave Species of God. It can be had by going to his website, www.slavespecies.com, or you can go to your local Barnes & Noble, also one of my favorite bookstores. So, Michael, in this hour, I would first like to also thank those radio stations that are still with us. I want our listeners to know there are two more hours of this program. If your radio station isn't carrying all of them, you should call them and ask them to carry all three. Okay, now, I guess what people are thinking is that we shouldn't be so arrogant as a race, should we? I mean, are we really at the top of the food chain? My guest has some amazing answers in his book, and I find it fascinating. I'm reading it as we speak in the breaks and even while he's talking, and I can't believe all the amazing discoveries that I'm making in it. I too have read a lot of the same books that he has, but haven't written the way he has, and I'm excited by it, and I'm going to definitely post the book on X Squared Radio's online store. So let me ask you a question. We're going to get into the DNA of humanity now, and we're going to talk a little bit about the origin of that DNA. I would like to know, how long were we once designed to live?
The answer to that is, I suppose, can come in various ways as one approaches the subject, because it gets quite diverse. Firstly, if one approaches it from the ancient scriptures, it tells you clearly in the Sumerian tablets, the translations talk about the fact that they created the new species not to live a long time. They talk about they made their years few in numbers, or their time small in numbers, or something to that extent. And it talks about how the part of the gene the part of the gene that gives you immortality has been removed. And they refer to the DNA as the tree of life, which is quite interesting, because we talk about in the Bible we have. In the Garden of Eden, we have the imagery of the tree and the tree of life and knowledge, and Adam and Eve weren't allowed to eat from that. Well, the Sumerian tablets, obviously, as I said earlier, predate anything written in the Bible by as much as 3,000 years, and a lot, if not most, of what is written in Genesis is a derivative of what was written previously in the Sumerian tablets. So they tell you very clearly that the tree of life was the DNA, and when they created this new primitive species, or as some of the translators call it, the Lulu Amelu, they were fashioned in a way that wouldn't allow them to live a long time. Now, I assume from the number of years that our ancient ancestors have lived, the people of biblical days, that there must have been some manipulation of our DNA since then, because we certainly don't live 1,000 years or 800 years like many of the people in the book of Genesis did. It certainly looks like our DNA has been manipulated to make us age rapidly and die quickly. So, and there are various reasons for that. I mean, if you were to create a new species that you didn't want to grow too smart and intelligent, you'd also make them, die off quickly, so that they don't live long enough to acquire knowledge and information and share that and so forth. But that's just an aside.
Well, sometimes I think about a race that's not wise enough. You know, we have all this technology laying in our laps and not the wisdom to use it, or at least we're misusing it. And then I think about maybe the dynasty of the wealthy, who would obviously be the ones who could access such immortality if there was a cost to achieving it. And so you would have, 200 or 300 or 400-year-old humans, and then you would have the rest of us that live, probably 60 good years and maybe 30 more years of aches and pains and invalidism.
Yeah.
So I could see, too, that if you wanted somebody to dig gold, 60-year-olds don't dig gold as well as 30-year-olds do.
Exactly. But I think there's a double-edged answer to that as well, Brooks, is that if they had the ability to clone humans to live to whatever age they wanted them to live to, my feeling is from from what I've learned out of this research is that they originally created them to live much longer, but then they started seeing the problems that came along with that. They got smarter much quicker, and they could share information with many others, and they would absorb more information the longer they lived. So I suppose, you know, they probably remanipulated the DNA of this new Homo sapiens species.
So they went back to the drawing board and weakened the design a little bit.
Exactly. And I'd like to come back to the phenomenal aspect of our DNA and some of the anomalies that just absolutely make no sense and which support a lot of this ancient writing in the Sumerian tablets. And even if you know, even a few years ago, 10 years ago, you would have still called me crazy if I'd uttered these things. And many of the authors that have written about these things, like Zachariah Sitchin and various others, have been called crazy and all kinds of names, and they got their skeptics. But, you know, the fascinating thing is that the more we discover in science, the more we achieve in science and technology and astronomy and genetics, the more it supports and corroborates these ancient Sumerian translations.
Isn't that amazing? And that
absolutely blows my mind. And as I read and I scratch more and I discover, even since I've published my book, I've discovered so much more that I'd like to add to it, or, you know, to put into a second volume, which I didn't even begin to scratch the surface with. And the one thing about the DNA is that the Sumerian tablets tell us how the Anunnaki, they refer to themselves as Anunnaki, or the Sumerian tablets, should I say, refer to these ancient gods who created mankind in their image as Anunnaki, who I'm sure you're familiar with since I looked at your website.
Well, I'm a little familiar with him, but I'm really familiar with John Gress, who's the writer and director of the movie that's coming out probably in October. It'll make the Sundance Film Festival, and it's called One Anunnaki, and it's the first in a series of three movies. And he, by the way, he's going to be on this program the 23rd, so you don't want to miss that. It's a world premiere.
I must tell you, I cannot wait to see that movie, because obviously it's the central core of the subject of my book. But what is interesting about what the tablets tell us about the Anunnaki is, and it describes in relative detail how they unwind the tree of life. So you've got to read between the lines. You know, it doesn't talk about DNA and genetics and things like that, and chromosomes and genes and so forth. It talks about it in a symbolistic way, but so much so that it actually leaves you with your jaw hanging open, because you cannot believe that some scribe in Mesopotamia some 6,000 years ago could have known anything about genetics and had written this kind of information down. And, you know, as much as you may be a skeptic, or as many people are skeptical about this information, it has been written, it has been recorded, and somebody must have been given this information to record on those clay tablets. And that I find fascinating. Now, who were those people that gave the scribes this information?
Sure. I mean, look at the Zohar, look at the Sefer Yetzirah, look at the Sefirot itself is a geometric mathematical design of the Tree of Life, the double helix. And there's even carvings in Palenque I'm thinking Piedras Negras down in Mexico, all kinds of carvings that at least ancient man had some kind of, maybe not a working knowledge of DNA, but they certainly had a knowledge that there was some kind of genetic jewel or key. And a tree of life, it means just as much sense to me as DNA or, you know, whatever it stands for.
Exactly.
It escapes me at the moment, but I'm sure they wouldn't have called it DNA back then. It's just as easy to call it Tree of Life, except if you called it that today, again, the ACLU would sue you into bankruptcy.
There are around the symbolism of the Tree of Life throughout all the human religions and ancient civilizations. Throughout all of them, there is a constant story that is told about the two brothers, starting with Enlil and Enki in the Sumerian context. There's Zeus and his brother Hades, who was depicted as the evil one and the devil who looked after the underworld and hell. And the Sumerian Enki and Enlil and Enki were depicted in the same way, as Enlil being the good one, the god, and Enki depicted as the devil or the serpent. And what's fascinating to see is that Enki symbolism throughout the ages and the earliest of times was the flying serpent, or the entwined symbol of the two serpents entwined. He is also described by the Sumerian tablets as the medicine man or the scientist who put together the idea and the concept of creating a new species and out of their DNA, cloning it out of their own DNA, and growing the embryos in the wombs of their own females. And he was depicted as the serpent, as the snake. The translation and the meaning of Eden or Eden is the abode of the holy ones, or the abode of the righteous ones, which refers to the early gods and settlers on earth who created the humans and what I call slave species. And in all of the ancient civilizations and their so-called mythology, and this is where I really have a bone to pick with our historians, because the moment they don't understand or they stop understanding where history ends, they start calling it mythology. And it has unfortunately done a great deal of damage to many people around the world, because now they just, you know, believe what mythology is. It can't be true. So in all the ancient mythologies, you've got the same story being told about the brothers, who the one who is the god and then the serpent, and the argument about the creation that they made and how they, you know, were put into the Garden of Eden and they weren't allowed to eat from the Tree of Knowledge. And then suddenly the creator, or the one that was represented by the entwined serpents, which is incidentally still the symbol for medicine today, as you know, and that was Enki in the Sumerian terms and Hades in Greek terms, they clashed, and Enki wanted to teach their offspring knowledge and give them information about who they are and why they were created and all this, and Enlil said, no way, you're not telling them that they're a slave species, they're here to work for us, we're not going to give them all this knowledge and information because that's power, we want to keep them dumb and stupid and enslaved, they've got to work in the mines for us. And then that's where the argument between God and the devil came, and the devil was banished from the Garden of Eden according to the Bible. In the Sumerian tablets it tells it the story slightly differently. It says that, you know, Enki was banished and he was sent down to the Abzu on southern Africa, which was where the mine was, the gold was being mined, and he wasn't to set his foot in the northern hemisphere again. And there's some fascinating stories about that. But to come back to the symbolism of the DNA and modern medicine today, the entwined snakes and the serpents goes back to the earliest days of humankind, and to probably as far back as the Garden of Eden, if you want to believe in such a place. And then you know, once we start talking about DNA and
do you think
genes,
we understand it? Do you think we understand the double helix called DNA?
we're not even close, you know. For most of your listeners may not be aware of this, or some of your listeners might be. You know, it is estimated that we only use about 2%, maybe 3% maximum of our DNA.
Really?
It is just an absolute phenomenon, and based on the number of genes that we have now discovered in our DNA, it makes absolutely no sense that we are at the top if we as you said, if we can call ourselves at the top of the food chain.
So you're saying there are portions of our DNA that appear to be switched off?
Absolutely. It seems to be pointing very, very clearly towards that kind of scenario. But what I find fascinating is the following, you know, that all hominids and ape species have 24 pairs of chromosomes, and chromosomes, for some of your listeners, are the particles in every cell that contain all the DNA material. What's fascinating is that humans have 23 pairs of chromosomes, and 22, and then there's the X chromosome and the Y chromosome, which are the sex chromosomes that differentiate men from women. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating is that all ape species have 24 pairs of chromosomes, which is basically two chromosomes more than humans have. And just over a year ago, early 2005, geneticists have discovered that our chromosome number 2 and number 4, by the way, as well, are like deserts of our DNA and genetic material. They contain very little information for the blueprint of our being.
Huh.
And then they go as far as saying that chromosome number 2 shows evidence of being fused, being a fusion of two chromosomes at the point of our human creation, which actually substantiates the fact that we are now human. That is the evidence that we are human, because we have this chromosome number 2, which is the fusion of two chromosomes, and that makes us human, as opposed to the ape species or the hominids that might have been here before us. Now, what is fascinating is that simply just corroborates what you read in the Sumerian tablets about when they decided to create this new species, or the slave worker. They took what they found, what I believe to be the Homo erectus creature running around on Earth. They refer to the creature as running around, and they describe it in various ways. And they took the DNA from Homo erectus, and they blended it, and they manipulated it with their own DNA. And as we said earlier, they switched some of it off, or they erased some of the parts of the DNA to make us more primitive and more stupid. And in that process, they must have eliminated one of the chromosomes, which then made us a new species, Homo sapiens. Now, our new scientists have all seemed to agree that, you know, this chromosome number 2 in the human DNA points to the fact that that's what makes us human. And here the Sumerian tablets from, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago tell us very similar stories.
Now, that is absolutely fascinating. So what we basically had was a world that was at a certain evolutionary state, or a certain creationary state, and then we had off-worlders that came here, discovered a man, although primitive in state, more animal than human, but nevertheless most of the raw materials to make a good worker, although obviously not bright enough to learn how to use tools or follow any kinds of instruction without you know, being taught every single minute. And they needed something a little bit more intelligent, a little bit more creative. And so what you're saying, and what the ancient records appear to say, is that that DNA was manipulated and then mixed with some of their own DNA. And I guess that could have happened one of two ways. They either could have, you know, taken tissue samples from themselves and done this in a lab, or they could have done it through breeding. But...
Yep.
Nevertheless, the result is a model that seemed to function for them. But what you're saying is clearly there's at least a portion of our DNA that did not originate here.
That's right. You know, so we, in many ways, we can arrogantly say that we are the aliens, you know. It's not we are the aliens, we are the aliens.
Yeah,
we're
the ET, aren't we?
Exactly, yeah. Part of our DNA, it comes from an extraterrestrial source that arrived on Earth and cloned their DNA with that of the Homo erectus species that was running around on Earth. So it's part of this planet, part of the evolutionary process. And that is why it is so difficult for anthropologists is to fit this missing link concept into the whole evolutionary spectrum. You know, there's this constant debate about the missing link. And, I mean, if you ask any anthropologist, you know, how many phases or stages of evolution should there be between Homo erectus and Homo sapiens? And the answer to that question is anything between 20 and 200.
Well,
you know?
Sure. So it's the same dilemma as how many licks does it take to get to the chewy center of a Tootsie Roll Pop. You know, it's completely subjective because what science does, and I'm fully aware of this because I've been not a victim of it, but certainly a product of its manipulation for many, many years. And that is this humanist attitude or the humanist philosophy, and that is that the way things are now is the way things always have been. They've always moved at this pace and with these forces working upon it, and so that's how they just backdate our current picture millions of years or hundreds of millions of years to come up with something that makes sense to them. And it's like, and I've told this story before on this station, but we are building our audience every week, and so I'll tell it again. The humanist believes that you could walk up to a kitchen sink in which a graduated cylinder is sitting under the faucet and has a certain amount of water in it, and the faucet is dripping. The humanist can look at his watch, count the number of drops per minute, and back calculate how long that graduated cylinder has been sitting under that dripping faucet. That makes perfect sense. That's a completely scientific approach, very empirical. But the catastrophist, which I believe you fall into the category of, believes that someone was in the room, put the empty graduated cylinder under the sink, turned it on, and then switched it off and left it dripping. And it's actually only been there about a minute or two, not 3 days.
Yep.
Some outside force came in, and what you're saying is there's evidence in the genetic code or in the genetic snapshot of some outside manipulation that spliced two genes together and added some other genetic material to make modern man.
Yeah. They didn't splice genes. They spliced the DNA. You know, they unraveled the double helix.
Oh, I see.
And created, cloned by genetic manipulation, a new species. And it is quite explicit in the Sumerian translations. And again, it's not, they don't use words like DNA and genes, but the tree of life and the entwined strands and they refer to the bit that you know, that gives you certain knowledge or certain characteristics. They refer to you know, genes in that fashion in the Sumerian tablets that are, you know, as we said earlier, some of them as 6,000 years old today. But it gets even more interesting once you start looking at the Human Genome Project and the information that is coming out of that. And during the research I was doing, I went to Wits University, which is my old university. I went to the Department of Genetics, and I interviewed the two top geneticists there. One of them is an American woman who heads up the plant side of the genetic department, and another gentleman whose name just escapes me now. Sorry, shocking, but I interviewed them both for an hour each. Yeah, and I recorded the conversation because I knew at some stage in the future it would become quite valuable. And what I was absolutely astounded by was their inability to think out of the box. They were just so dogmatic about what they believed and what they were teaching, and then suddenly it struck me. And this is what you raised right in the beginning of our chat tonight, is that why is it that this kind of information is not coming from the halls of established institutions, and it's coming from outsiders like myself and others who are often ridiculed as being mavericks or charlatans or con artists or whatever you want to call them. And the answer to that is actually very simple. You're not going to get anybody that is as a head of a department at an established university anywhere in the world that's going to jeopardize their position and their funding and their research funding by making crazy remarks or saying, well, you know, we're a bunch of aliens that we actually, the descendants of a bunch of aliens that came to Earth and created humans as a slave species and then you know, conned everybody into believing they were God and then they went away and this is the mess that they left behind. I don't think you're going to be very successful in raising a lot more funding for your department after that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, we're locked into this this human government. I call it the religion of science. And, you must be canonized or you cannot speak in the chapel.
Yeah. I had a few heated debates with scientists around Johannesburg. Fortunately, it's always normally over a beer or a glass of wine, so it wasn't, you know. there were always many escape routes during these heated debates. And I often, you know, I look at them and I go, you know, they tell me, well, you know, we're scientists. We work with science and we work with facts and our results are factually and sound and scientifically based. And I say, but hold on, you know, everything you do also starts with a theory. You have an idea, and it ends up being a theory, and then you try and go out to prove the theory, and to prove that you have to first accept certain standards and norms and make certain assumptions, and then sometimes you prove your theory and sometimes you don't. And many scientific theories that have been proven and scientific, you know, role models that have been with us for many, many years have, over years, been proven not to be as true or as accurate as they might have been when they were first postulated.
Fables. We call them fables now.
Yeah. So in many ways, sorry, Brooke, sorry to interrupt you. In many ways, scientists are just like theologians. They also have to have faith in what they're trying to achieve. But they go about it slightly differently. Obviously, the outcome and so forth is different. But I'm now, you know, getting too verbose here, but
that's all right. We often have an argument: whose robes are more glorious, those of academia or those of the clergy? I'd like to ask you what you think is locked up in the secret portions of our DNA.
Okay, that's the zillion dollar question, and the one that is going to hopefully unlock and bring us much closer to our makers, the so-called Anunnaki, or those that settled on Earth many thousands of years ago. It'll also bring us much closer to understanding what I believe is come in touch with our spirituality, which is a breath of fresh air for those that are of a spiritual kind of inclination, because I'm that way inclined myself. And I believe that, just to explain, just to reiterate again, that we use at this stage arguably as much as 3% of our DNA. The rest of it is completely ineffective and often referred to as junk DNA. And what is fascinating is what's coming out of the Human Genome Project is that the number of genes, one of the things they do when they start dissecting the DNA of a species is they count the number of base pairs in the DNA. The nice thing about the DNA is that it has a beginning and it has an end. It's not this infinite amount or infinite thing that you deal with. It has a very defined beginning and an end. So they can count the number of base pairs, the parts that touch each other and actually bond together between the two strands that formed the double helix. And so far, the human race, or Homo sapiens, has got the largest number of base pairs of the species that have been examined. And what is interesting is that there seems to be a very interesting correlation of the number of genes in a species and the length of its DNA. And one would assume that is a function of evolution. That certainly makes sense, and it follows, you know, the concept of evolution, that the species will evolve to the benefit of its own survival and survival of the fittest and so forth. So as you develop, your DNA develops, and you develop more genes in your DNA that give you that each gene gives you the ability to perform more and more intricate tasks and so forth. And when you start looking at the number of genes in different species, and this is what I find fascinating. I wonder, and I have not spoken to any geneticists about this of late, but they must be very confused about the findings that they're getting from the count of these genes, because it makes absolutely no sense. But what it does do, once again, the science that we learn today, or the discoveries we make in science today, just once again corroborate and support these ancient Sumerian scriptures that talk about this new slave species being created and their genes and their DNA being suppressed, so they weren't that clever. And the reason I can say that is if you look at the different species and you look at the number of genes they have in proportion to the length of their DNA, the human or Homo sapien uses the least amount of genes and space in proportion to their DNA, and has the less genes in proportion to their DNA than any other species.
Huh.
Some of the primitive species use as much as 98% of their DNA, and then it sort of goes down in number. But what is interesting, if I can just quote, I don't have it in front of me now, but the latest research I did was, you start with like single cell organisms, like a yeast cell, and that has like 3,000 genes, and a goldfish that has 12,000 genes, and then you go up to a chicken that's got 40,000 genes, you go up to a dog that's got 70,000 genes, and you go up to a chimpanzee, which most people by now know is our closest living relative, with basically 98 or 99% of the same DNA that we have. So the chimpanzee has about 130,000 genes, and automatically you would expect, the human would then have more genes than that. Well, that is not the case. Homo sapiens have, at this stage, the prediction is about 68,000 genes, which is about half that of the chimpanzee. So now you're going
to
step back and say,
so there is truth to the rumor that men are dogs.
Correct. Our number of genes is closely resembles that of a dog.
Okay.
You put your finger right on it.
All right. Keep making your point. You're leading up to something here.
Yeah. No. So once again, this information now suddenly you go, well, hold on a minute. If we're supposed to be the most mentally or intelligent-wise evolved species on this planet, okay, now let's not be arrogant, but let's be practical about this, okay? We have conquered this planet with our technology and so forth. So if we're supposed to be the pinnacle of evolution and so forth of all the species, then we should have the largest number of genes, because that's what would make us more intelligent and more advanced than all the others. But that is not the case. The chimpanzee has twice as many genes as the human being as of the latest research. And then you look back at the Sumerian tablets, and that's exactly what they say. They tell you that they took the Homo erectus creature that was living on Earth that had 24 pairs of chromosomes. They fused some of those chromosomes to make the Homo sapien, which now has 23 pairs of chromosomes. And in the process, they eliminated or switched off some of the genes which they possess. Remember that Homo sapien possesses much of the DNA of the Anunnaki, or their creator and their maker, as it says. The maker made us in his image, or in their image. Therefore, we have much of their DNA. But they didn't want us to be as smart as them, so they switched off a lot of that DNA, a lot of genetic activity. And in the process, they actually switched off so much that and took many attributes away from us, like longevity, possibly things like being born with the memory of your parents, and things like that, that a lot of our geneticists are now starting to grapple with and starting to believe that that's quite possible. And you realize that, again, the ancient knowledge of the Sumerians astounds us with the accuracy and with the information and the knowledge that they some scribe, some poor scribe in Sumeria, Mesopotamia, some 5,000 years ago, sat down and chiseled out on a clay tablet, and our scholars today just cannot wrap their heads around it. They cannot come to terms with it, and they'll find every reason in the world to try and fight it and discredit that kind of information, because it's just too incredible to them.
Well, you correctly stated in your book that the science of molecular biology was founded in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you that it so inspired my brother, Dr. William Scott Agnew, that he embarked on a PhD in that science, and he is today the director of physiology for Johns Hopkins. In his lifetime, and probably with his direct knowledge, because he may have actually been involved in the funding, countless projects have been imagined and funded relative to the human genome. And we know the cure to many of our weaknesses lies in that genome. We also know, we know that there are powerful kingdoms in science set up to prevent those cures from being made public. I mean, face it, the pharmaceutical industry would collapse if a cure for diabetes or cystic fibrosis or multiple sclerosis were found.
Absolutely.
And all of the funding that goes to researching the human genome, all of it comes from government grants or university grants.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm also a statistician, and one of the things that I do is I heavily doubt statistical studies that are done. For instance, a study comes out that says we should eat more bread. And when you look in the credits, it's put out by the American Wheat Council, or you should drink more milk. And sure enough, you look down at the bottom, and there's the American Dairy Council. And it's the same thing with the human genome. They say, well, you know, this is the origin of mankind, and here are the weaknesses in humanity, and this is what we need money for. And if you look down in the credits, lo and behold, there's the government. So I have to ask the question, you know, we've got a dilemma here. I mean, on the one hand, we have monumental forces expunging every record that man is a being created in the image of his maker. And on the other hand, we have the most advanced science in history telling us that very thing, that we are a created being.
Yep.
And just when we have the capability of spreading the word in an instant, like we are tonight, about the truth of our origins, we're full of fear to declare it. So why do you think this is? Why? I guess I'm driving to a specific point. We're going to cover that in our next hour. You know, the Anunnaki were involved in creating us. As far as I know, and I don't have all knowledge, even though I am a talk radio host, I don't think the Anunnaki are on the planet. If they are, they're hiding somewhere.
I use the following example in my live talks and my seminars is, you know, if you look at some of the biggest corporations in the world that are publicly listed, you know, Microsoft and, the, as you mentioned, the pharmaceutical companies, you can buy their stock, you can invest, and they should be transparent global corporations that we should know exactly what's going on in them because they're publicly listed. But we have no idea what decisions are made in their board meetings on a weekly basis or a monthly basis. We have no idea how they control our lives, what decisions they make, and we will never have an idea because that's not their intention. And so if we have no idea how these giant corporations that are supposed to be public corporations are controlling our lives, how could we possibly know how a group of even more advanced beings on Earth that exist and communicate with each other but are not publicly listed, if they make decisions from time to time how to steer the course of future human events. We'll
exactly.
never find that out.
Exactly.
And if they are on this planet, then we certainly are not aware of it, and we probably won't become aware of it, because they're still more advanced and smarter than we are, and they can withhold that kind of information from us. And for all we know, and this is now we're sliding into the whole conspiracy theorist arena, but for all we know, they might be controlling the media, the pharmaceutical companies, and all these giant corporations to whom they imparted their own knowledge to get them to a certain point. They might be controlling them so that they are actually in control of how this evolution of the human race proceeds and how quickly it progresses.
Well, I think that's an astounding conclusion. And I guess the question I have to ask is, are we ready to find what we're looking for?
Well, you know, I certainly hope that more people are opening their minds and becoming more tolerant, should I say, and less confrontational about their own beliefs and their own religious systems. We got to step away from those things we hold dear and actually look at our species, because we truly are on a knife edge right now. We could annihilate ourselves in the blink of an eye. You know, America invading Iraq, now they're talking about invading Iran. I mean, can you imagine what happens if America invades Iran? I mean, it's not going to be a pretty picture.
Well, you could ask the same question. Can you imagine what would happen if we don't?
Yeah.
Well, we start out as a slave species. We get, I guess, too smart for our britches. We rebel, and now, I guess, and I was gonna jump to a conclusion and say we're no longer a slave species, but we probably are still, and we're going to get into that heavily in our third hour. But, you know, we are explorers. There is the heart of an explorer, at least to the listeners of this program. That's what we're all about. We explore the mysteries of the universe and the Earth.
And I think that was, to a large extent, that was one of the reasons why the Anunnaki, or the our creators of the human race, actually withdrew their presence from this planet, or their visible presence and interaction with humans, is because they realized that it was getting completely out of control.
Yeah. Well, I think we're still out of control, because although the listeners to this program, and I would certainly like the entire world to be listeners to this program, we are explorers, but it's very clear after a 10-minute view of CNN that there are conquerors out there, and that's all they can think about. They want to build their missiles, and they want to launch them to other countries and cause them harm. Now, I can't fathom that. It's not in me to do. I wouldn't waste a minute of my energy to create such a weapon and do such a thing. But there are men that are driven to do that for some reason. So we have stratified our society. But I feel the same way that you just alluded to, that we are on a knife edge, and that soon we must make the ultimate decision as a race. Who or what is the race of man? Are we going to do the same thing we've done since recorded time and charge across the desert at each other headlong? Or are we going to finally realize that there's just one race and there's just one planet, so we might as well be one people? And
I believe, you know, Brooks, the one big problem we have to overcome is the many conflicting religions that we face in the world. And as shocking and as horrific as it might come to people that belong to a specific religion, it is truly a huge obstacle to overcome, because, you know, every religious person believes that they are right and that their religion is the answer, and that's why they believe in it, and that's why they follow that particular faith.
But that's what you kind of alluded to in the very first hour. When the Anunnaki created man, the first thing that they did was establish themselves as God over
man, and they
caused man to worship them and to idolize them and to dedicate a certain hour of a certain day or a certain week to revering them. And so there is the birth of your religion. And from there it splintered out, because I guess there wasn't just one Anunnaki. I mean, didn't they fight among themselves as well?
They did. They certainly did fight among themselves. We read that great detail in the very early Vedic scripts, the very poems, Vedic poems. I've got one right in front of me. I mean, it's fantastic to read, and I would really recommend to your listeners, if they do, when they do have time, just to go onto the internet and just type in Vedic scripts or Vedic poems, and read some of these. I think there's over about 1,028 of these scriptures that are, as far as we know, the oldest religion in the world and the oldest written document of early human behavior. Oldest referral to human behavior, oldest written document, because the Sumerian tablets are the oldest written documents that we have. But the behavior of these people in the Indus Valley, thousands of years ago, and some scholars claim that they can trace back these Vedic poems and the origins of these Vedic poems to as far as 8,000 BC, some even further than that. And when you read about all these interactions of these Hindu gods and these ancient Vedic gods, it's just unbelievable. I shall fight you with a celestial weapon given to me by Drona. He then hurled the blazing weapon. At last they came to blows, and seizing their maces, struck each other. They fell like falling suns. These huge animals, like mountains struck by Bhima's mace, fell with their heads broken, fell upon the ground like cliffs loosened by thunder. I mean, it goes on and on and on. As you said, clashes between the gods. And
so each one of these gods had their allegiances, and so their followers obviously warred against each other, just like the gods did.
Yeah. And one such god is referred to in the Bible, according to me and many other researchers of this subject, was the biblical god, and he was one of these Anunnaki gods who the ancient scriptures refer to, and he took the Israelites and he took them as his chosen people. And he took them to the land of milk and honey, but, you know, he said, "You are my chosen people." I mean, how could a God that created all man equal suddenly choose one small group and go and annihilate the rest because they didn't like them?
Well, some would argue that their genetic information was more pure, and that they had refused to breed with the off-worlders, and so therefore they were more human, I don't know. I have a question for you. The Anunnaki, were they giants?
Well, it certainly seems that way. You know, I'm sure you're alluding also to the many references in the Bible to the giants, like David and the battle between David and Goliath, and the Anunnaki, the scriptures, the Sumerian scriptures, should I say, also often talk about the giants and how the men were like locusts in their eyes and things like that. I was just reading an interesting bit of information before we started our debate tonight about a discovery in 1947 in California, in a cave, of some giants between 8 and 9 feet tall, and it's fascinating. I'm just trying to find it here. What do I do with this information? And it was in the Death Valley, 1947, a band of amateur archaeologists announced that they found a lost civilization of men 9 feet tall, and they were buried in 32 caves that covered some 180 square miles in California's Death Valley. And this is quite interesting.
Yeah, I don't see them on display in any museums in the U.S.
No, exactly, because a lot of these, this particular situation was basically shunned as nonsensical, and nobody followed up on it. So this is what I get from this particular article. But what I find interesting about this is, just see the link here, and this is why I think why one needs to, when you read these kind of things, you've got to look, step away from it and read between the lines. The whole scenario around the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, okay, is often referred to and more people are beginning to believe that it was actually a purposeful event, that was actually a nuclear attack on a particular on those two towns or cities, and then many towns next to it that destroyed it, and then basically caused a climate change and turned the entire area into a desert. Because prior to that, we certainly believe that we understand from historic events that Mesopotamia was pretty much like a Garden of Eden. The land between the rivers was green and lush, and there were plenty of crops. And today, it's nothing but a desert. The same with Death Valley and the deserts that surround that, where these skeletons were found. And I wonder whether there isn't a link. And then there's another, I'm jumping around a bit, but there's another situation in the Indus Valley near Mohenjo-Daro and those areas where there was also a similar situation in around 2000 BC, when some catastrophic event happened and destroyed cities and annihilation followed. And there seems to be this correlation, some sort of a link between them that certainly seems to spell out some...
A weapon of mass destruction.
Weapon of mass destruction. And there is a Sumerian tablets called the Era Epos, which describes very clearly the destruction and desolation and annihilation of the people, which is basically the mirror of what the Bible then calls the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And the fascinating interaction between Abraham and God and the two angels that come down and have a discussion with Abraham just prior to them then deciding to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. That is an absolutely fascinating bit of literature that comes from the Bible, which again is echoed in even greater detail in the Era Epos, the Sumerian tablets that talk about absolute annihilation and destruction and how, you know, nothing was left standing and everything was just blown away, and the evil wind that swept across the land and killed and destroyed crops and killed men and made them come out into the streets and cough up their organs, and their mouths were filled with phlegm, and their noses were bleeding and their eyes were popping out. And I mean, it automatically and immediately brings up images of the biological warfare that was perpetuated by Saddam Hussein on the Iranians.
Sure.
If you try and cast your mind back to the images of the people lying dead in the streets, when you read the Era Epos, it immediately brings back those kind of images, and you go, my God, what could those people have done that was so bad that God would have punished them so badly? And then you have to step away and say, but hold on, let's look at this. Who is this God that we're dealing with here? This is not. This certainly cannot be the God that I have a spiritual relationship with, and that I believe is the creator of the universe and all things in it, and I believe many other people do as well. This is a different kind of entity that we're dealing with here.
Exactly. Well, in our next hour, we will get more deeply into the subject of giants and Nephilim and maybe even their whereabouts. I want to thank those AM affiliates who carried us this hour and tell their listeners that we are here for yet another hour. It is going to be fascinating. You don't want to miss it. Of course, you can go to x2-radio.com or bbsradio.com, and you can listen to us on your laptop or your PC with your headphones, or you can call your local station and tell them to carry all 3 hours next week. I also want to open up the phone lines this next hour. The number's posted on the website, but if you're listening via radio, it's 888-268-4313, and that's from anywhere on the planet. We can take phone calls that way. My guest tonight is Michael Tellinger, and his fascinating book is Slave Species of God. And I am Brooks Agnew with X-Squared Radio, and this is where the past meets the future here. The results are always positive. We will take a short 5-minute commercial break, and we will be right back.
One of the things we have learned here at X Squared Radio from our emails is that many listeners to this program are educators. Well, we have recently added a great affiliate for you. The Academic Superstore is the place where you can buy software, neat tools and gadgets, and even supplies such as calculators and iPod peripherals at huge discounts. The best things for the classroom and for the student are just a tax-free click away. All you have to do is click the Academic Superstore sign at X Squared Radio and start saving. The space shuttle fleet is very soon going to be retired. No other spacecraft in history has advanced the world more than this fleet. I wanted a way to keep that memory alive in my home, so I went to the space store and ordered a 25-inch model of the Space Orbiter. People who have seen it always comment on the incredible attention to detail in this model. If you know someone who loves the space program and you want to get them a gift that they will never forget, you should visit the space store at X Squared Radio. You probably know Kevin Smith as one of the premier talk radio hosts in the world today. Well, now there is a new reason to know the name. His new book, Gods in the Garden. It's a shining light of truth in print that takes us back to the origins of mankind. Don't be afraid to find out who you really are and where you came from. The answer will open the windows of knowledge for you, so you can see everything for yourself. Visit his website at kevinsmithshow.com or purchase it at the online store at X Squared Radio today. People are always looking for something inexpensive and unique to give people they love. Well, now there is a way to give a gift that not only says how long you will love them, but it also allows you to help keep the planet green and growing. Tree Givers at X Squared Radio is the company that will plant a tree on public lands somewhere in the 50 states and provide your special person with a beautiful certificate of that placement. This has become one of the most popular gift sites in the world. And because of their love for the earth, they are changing the world. So visit Tree Givers at X Squared Radio and see if you can find a gift for your special person. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Our guest tonight is Michael Tellinger. His website, slavespecies.com, and his book is called Slave Species of God. We've had an absolutely fascinating discussion for the last 2 hours, and this is our final hour. So those AM affiliates that are carrying us this hour, we thank you. And we are opening the phone lines, so our phone number is 888-268-4313 from anywhere on the planet. And this hour,
I would like to talk a little bit about the subject of giants and Nephilim and maybe even their whereabouts if they're still on the planet. I think there's plenty of evidence that we've laid out in the last 2 hours that someone, whether they go by the name of Anunnaki, if we're pronouncing that correctly, or whether they go by other names, they are mentioned in literally every ancient writing that you can find, not only in the Vedic texts, but also in the Quran, also in the Old Testament of the Bible, also in the Popol Vuh, just about every ancient writing that you can find. And even in fairly modern history, Magellan ran into them as he was circumnavigating the globe. And as our guest mentioned at the latter part of the last hour, they were discovered in 1947 in Death Valley, California. And I alluded to the fact that their remains are not on display in the museums, and we were wondering why that was. But Nephilim, Anunnaki, Enki, and many other names we know, men of renown, off-worlders, aliens, creators, manipulators. So what is your understanding of the nature of the off-worlders themselves?
Yeah, Brooks, the interesting thing is that you mentioned that they are mentioned in all the civilizations and ancient scriptures and so forth. It goes not only in the civilizations that the majority of the people would immediately associate with, but what I find to be the most fascinating ancient civilization and ancient mythology is African mythology. And many people often forget to look at African mythology. And if we are, in fact, sort of anywhere near the truth about the origins of humankind, being created as a slave species, to work in the mines of Africa, to mine for gold. The fact that they were mining in southern Africa, where I'm just happen to be sitting in right now, what is fascinating to look at some of these ancient African civilizations and their belief systems, because they also believe, in fact, virtually all of them talk about the gods that came from the sky, who claim they claim that they were founded by a supernatural race of giant creatures that came from the sky and had sex with their women, married their daughters, and produced a powerful race of kings and tribal chiefs. That is basically across all the African ancient mythological beliefs. And then it varies from there. You know, they would have their little sideline stories that they wove around their particular experiences with these so-called giants that came down and created them and interacted with them. And it's absolutely fascinating. And what I find interesting as well is talking about giants from the sky. You may not be aware of this, but some of your listeners might be aware of it, Oprah Winfrey just recently was in South Africa to trace her Zulu roots, and she left here very excited because she believes that she found her Zulu ancestral roots. And what I'd like her to just be aware of, in case any of your listeners have contact with her, just tell her this very nicely, the Zulu actually has a fascinating meaning. The name Zulu actually means people of, not of the sky, but people who have the ability to travel in between planets, interplanetary space travel.
That's what Zulu means?
That's correct.
Wow.
And you know, what I mention in my book is that when you ask any sort of white anthropologist, and especially in South Africa, what does the name Zulu mean? And it's often incorrectly translated as, it means people of the sky, but that is the incorrect translation. The Zulus call themselves, they refer to it as, the name for sky is Isibakabaka, but the interplanetary space, however, is Izulu, okay, or Wedu Zulu, which means people that have the ability to travel between planets, interplanetary space, the dark sky that you see when you look at the stars at night. That's what they refer to. And and the Zulus also, just like basically all the other African tribes, way back to their origins, have the belief that they are thousands and many thousands of years ago, out of the sky came a race of giants who married their daughters and produced a powerful race of kings and tribal chiefs and so forth. And it's just fascinating. I find African mythology is so amazing because it is so naive in its structure. And yet, when you look at the hundreds and hundreds of different mythological beliefs and the tribes throughout history, they all point towards the same conclusion, as I just mentioned. They were created. Yeah.
I just had a vision, a memory of, I had first seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and I remember when the French scientist went to Africa, and all these people were on the ground in the desert, and they were chanting the tone, you know, that plays in the movie.
Yeah.
And they asked them, you know, from where did the sound come in their language? And everyone shot their fingers up at the sky and pointed to the sky. So
yeah.
That's the vision that I got. So, well, that is so fascinating because even in areas like Spain, they have elaborate buildings like almost like castles built as a place where the virgins of mortal men were presented to the Nephilim that resided with them, so that nightly he could inseminate a different earth woman every night.
Yep.
And the offspring became various races of giants.
Yep.
So do you know their origin? I was going to ask you, do you know of the Dogon Indians?
Well, Dogon Indians, there's not only the Dogon Indians, but there's also the Dogon people from the African Dogon people. That's what I'm talking about.
I mean, don't they number Earth as planet number 7, not planet number 3?
I'm not exactly sure about the Dogon people, but some of the African tribes actually do know is they'll tell you that there are 24 other planets in the solar system. And this is, you know, again, where historically scientists and any sort of self-aware person would have told you, oh, what kind of rubbish are you uttering there? You know, please, you know, crawl back into the hole you came out of, you ignorant imbecile. And what actually... What amazes me is, once again, as I said earlier, the more we discover with science and in astronomy, the more it supports the ancient scriptures of the Sumerians that tell us about these incredible events of our prehistory and of our own human origins. If I, for example, said to you, even 2 years ago, said to you that there were more than 9 planets in the solar system, you would not have believed me and you would have called me an idiot. But then suddenly, our scientists, our astronomers discover that while during star formation and planetary formation around a new star actually undergoes 2, sometimes even 3 phases, and that the first phase of planetary formation creates planets that are flung far and wide away from the star and that are on relatively erratic and irregular orbits of many thousands of years around that particular star, and then a period of break takes place, and then a second period of planetary formation happens, during which the more stable planets closer to the star are formed, of which Earth is one. And our known solar system is the second part of our planetary formation in our solar system. And only now did they discover that, my goodness, there's a whole lot of other planets that were formed in our solar system that we're not even aware of, that are on much larger orbits, and that we're probably only going to discover in years to come. But guess what? These planets were probably seen by ancient civilizations and referred to, but we have no reference what these people are referring to. So we think that they were hallucinating or they were just stupid or something like that, so we just ignore it.
Well, when you look at the Babylonian seals, though, what you see is that it wasn't the earth dwellers that saw them in the heavens and numbered them and named them. They were taught that these planets were out there and what their orbits were by the off-worlders that came here.
Yeah.
They were taught astronomy, this, you know, same way that you and I would be taught astronomy if we went to a university, except they were taught by people who had traveled by there and actually seen it.
Yeah. What's interesting, while you're talking about people that have traveled there, so now that we've established that, you know, there are more than 9 planets in the solar system, and we shouldn't be so arrogant as to think that our ancient civilizations were just stupid or they you know, didn't know what they were talking about. They knew very well, as you said, what they were talking about, and they were teaching their children what they knew, and they depicted it in their seals and in their clay tablets. But our historians have just discarded it because they didn't understand it. And once again, because of their ignorance, our modern ignorance, it just gets relegated to the realm of mythology, which is really very sad.
Mm.
So to undo that kind of mindset across a global population, that people that now believe this all mythology, I mean, you know how difficult that's going to be, obviously.
Yeah, well, it's I guess socially acceptable to call it a myth when we talk about an angel being cast down or cast out of one realm and manages to come to Earth. But that is precisely what the records speak of, is it not?
Correct.
I mean, what is the name for a cast down angel?
Well, the Bible refers to them as cast down angels, but the Bible also refers to them as the Nephilim, correct?
Right, the Nephilim, and then there's the word Nephal.
Nephal, to fall down or cast down, or various other similar explanations.
But you know, it's interesting. The word Nephilim only shows up, a couple of times in the Old Testament. But if you look at the other records, like you look at the Zohar or you look at other Jewish, even contemporary Jewish records, and even the Book of Enoch, I mean, they're just replete with it. They're full of references. As commonplace as we talk about immigrants coming to this country, they were immigrants coming from other worlds. Yeah. And according to your book, the reason that at least some of the ruling off-worlders that came here, part of the reason they came here was to find raw elements, to find gold. And I guess I want to ask, why in the world would they need gold as advanced as they were?
Yeah. Thank you for coming back to that question, because that ultimately is the main reason why we were created as the species, the new species on this planet. And I'd like to add immediately is that because we were created out of context on this planet, that's why we've become such a psychotic species. I mean, look at what we're doing to ourselves. We don't know the reason why we're here. We don't know, you know, anything about our origins. We surround ourselves with dogmatic religion that in most cases has caused most of the strife and upheaval on this planet. And it's a really sad state of affairs. But to come back to the original reason why this species called Homo sapiens was created is really the beginning of the whole story of humankind. And as you said, when the Anunnaki, or these travelers, arrived on this planet called Earth, it wasn't by accident. It was by the most definitely pre-planned. They were looking for a very specific metal, and that metal was gold. And with that, by creating the slave species and introducing the concept of slavery to humankind, and making the people dig for gold, this new slave species dig for gold, they immediately set up the two common denominators that I said right up in the beginning of our discussion, is that I can trace the two common denominators to the earliest days of humankind is the obsession with gold and the practice of slavery. Now, it makes absolutely no sense why a species would obsess themselves with those two ideologies from the earliest primitive state that they were in. And the reason why these settlers came to Earth looking for gold is they had very similar problems on their planet that we have right here on Earth right now, and those are environmental problems.
Uh-huh.
We know that we are pretty much, you know, hovering on the brink of irreversible climate change because of what we're doing to this planet. And,
I don't know if I wouldn't go so far as to say that. I would say that we are on the brink of an ice age, and we are on the brink of a very cataclysmic climate change, and it is because of greenhouse gases building up in our atmosphere. But the greenhouse gases aren't coming from men. They're coming from natural things that are occurring in the earth, methane coming up out of the sea, volcanic eruptions. One volcano, just one, puts out more greenhouse gases than all the cars that have run on the earth since the beginning of time.
I must agree with you on that. I mean, sometimes one gets caught up, and I'm sort of paraphrasing a dear friend of mine whose favorite pet subject is bird flu and global warming. You know?
Well, I don't want anybody to have the misconception that if we all go back to bicycles right after the 4th of July, that the Earth will somehow heal itself. It's not going to happen. All of the planets in our solar system are undergoing global warming right now.
Yeah.
And they're even changing their revolutionary speeds. Saturn's revolutionary speed has changed a whopping 9 minutes in a mere 18 years.
Is that the revolutionary speed of Earth?
Well, yeah, it is amazing that there are forces that are at work, and yes, there is global warming occurring, and yes, that is the precursor to a sudden and cataclysmic ice age. But don't fall into the politics that you need to
start riding a bicycle.
So you don't need to fall into one camp or another. You're not doing anything wrong, but there are things that you need to do to prepare for that kind of thing. But that's another subject. So the answer that you gave me was that the reason they were looking for gold is because they had environmental problems on their planet, and it was, I guess, strongly believed by them that if they hauled gold back to their planet, they could either delay or fix or reverse those cataclysmic changes.
That's certainly what comes out of the Sumerian tablets very clearly.
Wow.
They describe the translations describe the effects on their planet by their climate change, and what they refer to as the breach in the shield around their planet, and I assume that it would be something similar to an ozone layer. But at the same time, we must also be very careful about this, because the planet we're talking about, as the Sumerian tablets refer to as the planet Nibiru, and many, many times refer to it by that name. We are also told about the other aspect of that planet, the fact that it was a radiant planet because of its large orbit around the sun. It had to have its own heat and energy for people or beings to survive on that planet.
Of course, it would be a frozen rock that far out.
Exactly. So that's another interesting thing, because it's one of the first things that, you know, the scientists will throw at you. How can you sustain life on a planet that's so far away from the sun? So, well, the way you sustain it is like in the following way. And the Sumerian tablets, again, tell us that that's how they sustained life, and that's how they lived there. And they had a pretty temperate climate by the description in the tablets, until they started experiencing problems with the protective shield around their planet that they refer to in various ways, and they had to do something about that. And the one thing that they discovered would solve their problem and be able to help them heal the breach or the break in their protective shield was gold.
I hope that they mined enough gold to fix the breach in their planet, or are we going to expect another kind of immigration very soon?
That's a zillion-dollar question, isn't it? Are we still holding gold out to help them heal the breach in the atmosphere and the protective layer? I don't know. I mean, what's happening to all the gold that we're hauling out of the Earth? From my research, it seems that in the Indian continent, or Asian continent, mainly India, consumes possibly as much as 70% of the global gold production for purposes of jewelry. Now, that's
a lot of jewelry.
Exactly. I find that absolutely fascinating to even try and wrap my head around. What has happened to all the gold since we first started mining it in the world? Why have all the ancient civilizations right across the world, right across from the ancient Americas to southern Africa and all over Africa and wherever else you go, one of their main obsessions was to mine gold. And when Cortez and the other explorers that arrived in America in the early exploration days arrived and they started raiding all the Native Americans' golden vaults, and they would ask them, where does all this gold come from? Who does this gold belong to? They would have a single-minded answer for them. As you know, they point to the sky and say, the gold belongs to the gods.
Well, I know that there were gold libraries and there were whole buildings that were leafed with gold on the outside. I can just imagine when the Spaniards showed up and they went to Teotihuacan and they saw, you know, the Temple of the Sun and, you know, white alabaster building, I don't know how many hundreds of feet high it is. I climbed it once at 8,000-foot altitude, and I thought my lungs were going to pop out of my chest. But, yeah, I have a couple photographs from the top of the Temple of the Moon, and it's just breathtaking what had been built for them. But to see the scope of what they had done with gold and that it was so commonplace, it was like paper to us here. It was of no value to them whatsoever.
But now you can start understanding why the human obsession with gold. If you just take it backwards, step by step, like you said, the dripping tap into the vessel, you can now start unraveling this human obsession with gold. Okay, so here we are as a new species on this planet. All we know, all we've been doing since the earliest days of our existence is mine gold and dig for gold and be, you know, controlled and punished by these gods, these other beings that keep appearing and disappearing out of nowhere, reprimanding us, telling us what to do, and then, you know...
and robbing one another of our gold.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people don't realize how much gold was hauled out of South America. In the Gulf of Mexico, I just read this, in the Gulf of Mexico, it's reported that there are over 700 barge chains, and these... Evidently, the Spaniards couldn't put sails on all the vessels to haul gold on. So what they do is they chained barges together and had one sailing boat to pull all the barges full of gold. Well, I don't know
how many across the Atlantic.
Yeah, but 700 of these barge trains sunk in the Gulf of Mexico, and still enough gold made it to Spain to ruin that country.
Well. What's interesting, there's a theory or I read somewhere, I can't remember where this was now, where they talk about the amount of gold that was hauled from the Americas to Spain during that first sort of 200 or 300 year period was more than had been mined in the world since then.
Oh my goodness.
So that's an interesting, whether it's true or not, I don't know, so don't hold me to it, but it's an interesting concept to even try and wrap your head around, you know?
Well, it's obviously not a rare metal, a rare element, and yet it was so plentiful on this planet and needed by another planet, it makes sense that they would come here. Now, in our last hour, I want to kind of change gears a little bit, and we talked a lot about gold, but in your book, you mentioned this, and I find this just very stimulating. I want to ask you a question. Who was Marduk?
Marduk is the, according to the scriptures, the Sumerian scriptures, was the son of Enki, who was one of the first two brothers to arrive on Earth to set up the base and set up the mining operations. In fact, Marduk was the firstborn son of Enki, who was, as I mentioned earlier, was the geneticist, the scientist who came up with the idea of creating the new slave species, who was also represented by the entwined serpent or the flying serpent, and who eventually created the the new race of beings, the slave species on this planet.
And who did he, who did Enki father Marduk with?
Marduk.
Mortal woman or an off-worlder or.
Marduk is a tough one. I think you got me there. Now I must tell you, it's Marduk was actually his son from as far as I remember was his son from. No, Marduk was not in according to my research was not an offspring of a female Earthling and an Anunnaki.
Okay.
There was another character called Adapa, which was the offspring of Enki and his earthly concubine. There were actually two sets of creation, pretty much like the Bible also spells it out. Again, as we said earlier, the Bible is pretty much a copy of what is written in the Sumerian tablets. But after Enki created the human race and Adam and put them in the Garden of Eden and made them work in the mines, after that he had another child with a female, an earthling female, and from that came Adapa, who was, in his opinion, the first intelligent slave species, or what he referred to as the first intelligent offspring that he created, and he was very excited about Adapa. And this is where it becomes very interesting, because this, for the first time, even as far back as that, we already start playing the race card, because the first human created was described very much as being black. They describe his the color of his skin as being the dark brown, the color of the African soil, dark hue. And then when Adapa was born, he was described as being radiant like the rays of the sun, and his eyes were the color of the sky, and in many ways it's also echoed in the Book of Jubilee, which is an apocryphal book, when Noah is described as his body was white as snow, and his father basically saying that this can't be his son, because it says in the scriptures that I have begotten a strange son, diverse from and unlike man, and resembling the son of the God of heaven.
Yes, and Lamech was very upset about that.
Yes, and so there's a very interesting sequence of events that happened here, which is too much to try and I suppose capture in a discussion like this, because there's a lot of characters that play very important roles in this. But
well, Marduk is important because he's, I think, one of the first names that I ran across in my research that really had a lot to do with sort of Egypt coming to power and
correct,
maybe the establishment of their system of government and their religions and their pyramids. And so Marduk was extremely important. Did Marduk have other names or?
Marduk, yes, he did. But please don't hold me to that right now. Let's stick to Marduk right now. What I'd like to just come back to on Marduk is he played a pivotal role in all of the happenings in and around the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, the so-called the Egyptian rulers, because according to the Sumerian tablets, his father Enki actually and his brother Enlil actually gave Marduk the land of Egypt, where he then established his kingdom and started to rule slightly completely differently to how the rest of the world was being ruled, and that's really interesting if you look at Egyptology and how all those gods started to evolve, and Marduk proclaimed that all the pharaohs in Egypt had to be offspring of what he referred to as the Netiru or the Igigi. Netiru were referred to as the watchers or the Igigi, who were also another name for those who came to Earth from Mars.
Huh. Well, why do you think it was important for the rulers to come from that lineage?
Well, I suppose he wanted the rulers of, in his part of the world that he was in charge of to be his offspring or somehow related to him, so that they were more superior, either genetically or mentally. I'm not quite sure for what reason. But it certainly also shows, if you look at the earliest pharaohs and if you look at the color of their skin, again, we get to the race card. It's fascinating how far back the whole race issue goes. Because if you look at the depictions of the earlier pharaohs, they're always depicted as very light-skinned and very royal and regal and superior, while all their slaves and their subordinates and those that served them all had darker skins, often black hair, short black curly hair, as the Sumerian tablets often referred to as the black-headed ones. It's only much later, when the Nubian kings started taking over, that they started having black pharaohs in Egypt. But that was probably like 1,500 years later, even more. Sorry, 3,000 years later.
Well, how long did Marduk rule?
Well, that's also a good question, but it was probably for about it sounds about probably between 3,000 and 5,000 years. It all depends how you structure the timeline in that era. But he seems to have set up the early Egypt, all the kingdoms and so forth. And then he seems to have vanished because he wanted to declare himself as God above all. He had a bit of a bone to pick from what the tablets seem to convey, because he was the firstborn son to Enki, and he was promised Earth, this planet, as his to rule in time to come. And as the time, passage of time went by and memory eroded, different situations evolved, suddenly Marduk was no longer offered the planet as his to rule, because there were other things happening on this planet, and they didn't expect to, having problems with this new species that they created and so forth. And suddenly there were more of the Anunnaki offspring who wanted part of the planet for themselves, and they had to divide the planet up between the different offspring. And this is where we start getting the interesting civilizations, like the fascinating situation that happened in the Indus Valley, where Inanna, or the goddess of love, was given that part of the world to rule. And if you look at the ancient Indian culture and the very high sexual sex sort of drive and the Kama Sutra and the whole approach to sex, and the fact that it actually was given to the goddess of love or the daughter who was that way inclined, it's fascinating stuff.
So, well, I can see how this division happened. So, were these the ones that became the Titans, or are Titans yet another group of great rulers that warred with one another?
Yeah, it certainly seems that Marduk was heading up the new rival faction. As I said, he had a bone to pick, and he was determined to take over the planet. He declared himself God above all, which didn't wash well with his uncle, Enlil, who was in charge of everything here, and even more superior to his father, Enki. He went, from what it seems like, again, he went on a sort of global expedition to try and convert people to believe in him and actually, side with him as the ruler of this planet. And it was at that time, around 2050 BC, when Abraham was summoned by God, and this is where a fascinating part of our early biblical history comes to play itself out, where God comes down and he talks to Abraham and says, listen, I believe that the people of Sodom and Gomorrah are conspiring against me and behaving badly, and they're vile and evil. one would say, well, what is it that they were doing, that they were conspiring against God? I mean, how could they conspire against God? And then suddenly when you look at what Marduk was doing, he left Egypt and he was traveling the rest of Mesopotamia and even further east into India, in this valley. And he was just, you know, supposed, you know, getting new recruits for his in support of himself. And my guess is that what happened here is that Marduk became quite active in some of those towns like Sodom and Gomorrah, and started telling people certain things that Enlil didn't want them to know, and telling them to side with Marduk, and that he was the god above all. And then suddenly, it seems like that they started the first sort of, you call them revolutionary factions or revolutionary little groups of pockets of revolutionary fighters started forming in the towns like Sodom and Gomorrah. They were conspiring against God, you know, God with a small g. And Enlil, who, according to my research, was the god with a small g of the Old Testament, didn't like this at all. And he came down and he asked his you know, main man, who was Abraham and at that stage, to go out and sort this out, because he didn't want this new wave of resistance building up against Enlil. And he knew that he couldn't fight the people himself. He had to get people on his side, and Marduk was doing the opposite. And that's when suddenly we have the decision that was made to destroy those cities with nuclear weapons. And in the Era Epos, we find very graphic descriptions of how these weapons were taken out of hiding, how they were charged and loaded, and how they were dispatched, and the seven evil weapons that destroyed the cities and the whole valley, and the other cities next to them or around them.
And so the social and economic control system that Marduk was putting in place all over the planet, I guess I know that Sodom and Gomorrah, besides, you know, being a center of debauchery, was also one of the wealthiest cities in the entire world. It was literally a pleasure city. Which we have cities like that now in our world. If you have enough money, you can go and do anything you want to do, and what you do stays there. We even advertise it on television all the time.
Exactly.
And I guess in the final 15 minutes of our program, I want to talk about the slave species, the modern slave species. Do you think, and I haven't read your whole book, but do you think that we are still enslaved as a species?
I'm convinced. Absolutely. Just look at the way we behave. We're enslaved by money.
Money.
The fact that the world is really run by money. We're born, we go through school, then we start to work, and then we retire and we die. If you don't have enough money, you'll just be ostracized. You will not lead a decent life. You'll probably not be too happy, because you'll be miserable. And I'm exaggerating now, obviously, because there are people that live reasonably frugally and are happy. But in general, we are born to make money and then we die. And there is definitely a place in time in history that money was introduced into the social structure. And once again, I'm of the opinion that that was a brutally calculated event that was planned and executed by the Anunnaki to introduce a new tool as an enslavement tool into the human race, into the slave species. Because suddenly these new humans are running around and causing chaos and multiplying at a rapid rate, they needed another way of controlling them, so they introduced the concept of money to them, and from then started a whole bunch of new problems that we're still dealing with today.
Well, do you think their design was so perfect that it's self-perpetuating, or do you think that somewhere behind the scenes, and maybe at the top inner dark rooms or caves of trickle-down economy, global economy, do you think there are still Anunnaki at the helm?
I'm probably inclined to believe that they are Whether they're at the helm or not, I'm not sure, but my gut feel is that they're still around. Whether they're involved in our politics or not is a huge question.
I think my personal opinion is that our politics are nothing more than a tinkling sound. They don't have any effect on the planet whatsoever. We change presidents or prime ministers or governors or drug lords like we change our socks, and it makes no difference. The system plods forward decade after decade, ensuring its flawless control of every single human on the planet. There's no way out of the system, it seems. And a system that perfect, that well designed, and that frustrating, especially aided by the technology that we have today, and we could do another show on that altogether, aiding that enslavement to where you cannot buy, sell, or trade without money, and then it's only one step away to remove the money and replace it with some sort of electronic signal that they can control even more and track even better.
Yep.
When you look at the ancient carvings, and I'm assuming that we're looking at Anunnaki or Nephilim, when we see kings in the center and then behind them these winged beings with little pine cones and handbags in their hands, and they're standing like behind the kings and they're advising them or they're sprinkling them with wisdom or some kind of symbolic thing, it is clear that the Anunnaki or the Nephilim are not ruling the planet, but they're ruling the kings, and the kings are ruling the planet.
Yeah. Well, in many of the ancient civilizations, in China especially, there was a very clear hierarchy, you know, from gods to the kings to the next level down, and then so it filtered down through to the high priest, to the king, to the king's assistant or whatever, and then they had a very feudal, hierarchical feudal system in Chinese history, and that seems to have come straight from the Anunnaki and the earliest control of their species on this planet.
Well,
but what I find interesting is that throughout all the scriptures, the Sumerian scriptures, the Anunnaki don't ever refer to money or value or cost or anything. So I would assume that in their state of evolution on their planet, on Nibiru, they had possibly gone through the phase that we are going through right now, and they understand its problems and how long it took them to get out of the trap of capitalism and being in a trap of money and things having value that you have to trade because it certainly seems like they didn't have that, was not anywhere on their agenda. They came here for a specific reason, to get gold, and money was only introduced much later, much, much later, only a few thousand years ago, really.
The conclusion you have to draw from that, when you have a being that can live for thousands of years, who is fertile, who is intelligent, is they must first gain control over their ability to populate before they gain control over the economics. Because, face it, if we today were to suddenly step forward and say, you no longer need money to survive or prosper on this planet, you will be provided for. Why? Our population would explode like paramecium, and we would poison our planet so quickly we'd kill ourselves off as a race. We'd be like rats in a maze. Because we proliferate and we have no control over it. In fact, if you go to the poorest countries, or the poorest states for that matter, anywhere you want to go where the people are very poor and thus have little access to education, their population's completely out of control. They have 12, 15, 18 children and 10, 12 wives. It's exponential, the growth. You must first gain control over your ability to populate and populate a planet before you can release people from economic control. I see their wisdom, but I also see that it does create a stratification between the wealthy and the poor, and the fact that there may be wealthy people who don't
deserve to be wealthy. They're neither intelligent nor charismatic nor benevolent in any way. They're vile, self-serving, sensual people that just consume everything in their path.
Yep.
And they don't deserve to be wealthy. But I guess we don't have control over that. But I don't know. My closing comments, I guess, with you are that I think you're dead right. I think that there is an intelligent race who comes here or is still here, who has designed the system and is working the system and manipulating the system. It may have its ups and downs like a stock market does, but generally it is working exactly by design.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to add to that is just the listeners that have been with us tonight is just keep an open mind and explore. Do your own exploration, you know. If you want, you can read my book. There's many other books you can read. And it'll certainly give you food for thought, and it'll make you want to find out more. That seems to be the common feedback that I'm getting from people that have read my book. And just say, you know, thank you for opening my eyes, and thank you for giving me the tools to go out with and find more and explore more and you know, empower myself with more knowledge and information, because we certainly do not have the answers. What we have been taught is not necessarily so.
Well, I support that 100%. I'm all about empowerment. An empowered people cannot be completely enslaved. And as long as our minds are open or willing to communicate with one another, I think that even war can be avoided. I, like you, think that maybe the race is on the verge of a metamorphosis, that we, at least some of us, at least most of us, I think, are ready to lay weapons down and to realize who we are and what our planet is. And the fact that maybe now we at last can explore the stars and expand our exploration.
That's it. We sooner or later we have to leave the cradle of humanity and of humankind. And Earth is the cradle of humankind. And we're now going to join, as I put in my book, we're going to join and rejoin the universal community of beings, because they must be and they are, in my opinion, many civilizations and out there that live and populate the universe and travel and interact and do all kinds of things and explore, and that is the beauty of the universe. As life evolves on one planet, it allows it to springboard into other planets and explore them, and we are getting to that point now, and I believe that the one thing that the Anunnaki did not count on when they created this slave species to mine their gold is the evolution of the mind and the evolution of the spirit and the soul, which evolved much quicker than the physical evolution of the DNA that drives the physical aspect of our being. And that I find quite interesting, because we're now at a stage where we're questioning our spirituality, our existence. How do we fit into the big picture, not just as on this planet of ours, but into the big universal picture? Where does God fit into it? God with a big G, not just God with a small G, which I believe we've been preoccupied with for too long on this planet. And we're now at a crossroads, ready to actually start coming to terms with our place on this planet, who we are, where we come from, and why we're here. And once we have accepted that, once we can come to terms with why we're here, and if it is the horrible truth that we were created as a slave species, then let's deal with it and move forward from there, because there's no turning back. We have to move forward.
I would love to be on the ship that leaves this planet, goes to another, visits another race, and we step off, and they say, oh, you're descendants of that slave species that Enlo and Enki created so long ago. And what is it that you're here for? Do you want to take gold back to your planet? And we'll say, no, we have everything we need. We just came because we want to know.
Yes. We just came to visit, you know,
yes.
See if you, okay, need some help. And by the way, we just discovered a new way of time traveling, and, you know, if you haven't discovered it yet, we'll help you along.
I can't wait for that day. I hope that it has already occurred and they've already come back to the past and listened to this program and been amazed at how prophetic we were and looking forward to those days when we're no longer enslaved the way we were. And whether they meant it or not, the creation got out of their control and we became free. And
yep.
I think that hopefully that freedom will become an earthbound trait. One day we will learn to live with it and deal with it.
Well, you know, we said it right up front. You can't hold back science and discovery. It will occur whether you try and prevent it or not. And as much as there may be forces on this planet trying to prevent us from discovering certain things and getting to know them, sooner or later, we will get to the point where we will finally, you know, unveil the truth and discover more planets and travel to new places and find things that we possibly previously were taught was taboo.
Well, I hope that you're right, and I really sincerely mean that. I read that you're right. I honestly desire you to be right, and wouldn't it just be so fascinating if one day while looking through the solar telescope, looking at our sunspots and wondering about the cosmic radiation that's blowing our way, and all of a sudden from behind the corona peaks the edge of another planet, that of
yep.
Nibiru.
Well, the tablets certainly talk about that in great detail and how the planet appeared in the sky, the red glowing planet appeared in the sky, and they refer to it, as you know, as a planet of the crossing. And that, incidentally, is, for many listeners may not be aware of it, is where the symbolism of the cross comes from, which is possibly one of the oldest symbols next to the entwined serpent and the symbol for medicine. The symbol of the cross is one of the oldest symbols that we have on
That's
this
correct.
Planet.
That's correct.
For thousands and thousands of years represented the planet of the crossing, the planet Nibiru, from whence came knowledge and information, and God came from the sky, from heaven. Nibiru was often referred to as heaven. God came to earth every time Nibiru would pass by. Then God would come down, and the angels would come down from Nibiru and bring new technology, new information, and healing as well, which is interesting because the cross also represents a hospital, like the Red Cross and healing.
Mm-hmm.
So the symbolism of a cross goes back many, many thousands of years, and in African, ancient African mythology and civilization, they knew the cross long before the Christians started moving into Africa to convert people.
Right. Well, that sound means that we are closing our program. My guest tonight has been Michael Tellinger, and it has been my absolute pleasure that you have been on our program tonight. I appreciate your staying up late. It's been a long night for you, I'm sure.
Brooks, thank you very much for having me. It was a great pleasure talking to you, and I loved every second of it. Thank you very much.
Excellent, excellent. And we'll have you back on another time.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Good night. Thank you for listening to X Squared Radio. Remember, Earth Explorers, who you are. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe. So try to do it on purpose every day. Life is immensely valuable. Reach out to the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is your host, Brooks Agnew, with X Squared Radio, saying, peace, Earth Explorers. See you next Sunday evening at 5 p.m. Eastern.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.